Welcome to the Whiskey Rebellion. This is David Silkenet in Edinburgh, and I'm joined this time, this week, by Frank Cagliano, who is sitting on my couch, as opposed to being live on Skype from Charlottesville. Good to be back, is it?
It's great to be back. Hi, David. Hello, listeners. I'm back. I'm back in Edinburgh and very for the holidays, and thrilled to be here and thrilled to see you, David.
I thought you would come back to do the podcast, Frank. So it's the holidays that has brought you back to Edinburgh. That's fine. I won't take it personally. Great. So in some ways, the holidays are appropriate because that's going to be the topic of our show today. We're going to talk about the holiday season, as some people call it, or the Christmas season, as other people might want to think about it, and the war on Christmas.
What did you do in the war, Dad? We have not been drinking eggnog. No, I want to make that clear. Not yet.
Not that. That's later. Or whiskey, for that matter. I don't know what's in your mug, though. It's hard to tell. But we want to talk about this idea that's become, I think, rather a prominent trope this time of year, especially on right-wing television and radio, that there is a war on Christmas, and we want to sort of disentangle that. So where do we think this war on Christmas trope begins, Frank?
Well, I mean, we're going to look at the history of Christmas in the United States in due course this morning, David, but I think the war on Christmas as a more recent trope really goes back about 25 years to the mid-90s. To some extent, it almost exactly coincides with the founding of Fox News. Because this has been a hardy perennial on Fox News and, the broader Fox News universe. Over the past 25 years, this assertion that somehow Christmas and by extension Christianity in the United States is under threat and must be defended. I note, David, as I look across your desk, that you have a Starbucks
cup, yes,
on your desk.
A seasonal Starbucks cup.
It seems to be seasonal, but I don't see that it says Christmas on it.
It does not say Christmas or Happy Holidays or any such thing. It just has the red and white and a little bit of green to indicate the seasonal nature. Although they were selling the Christmas blend at Starbucks.
And they called it Christmas
blend.
Right. So
They're trying to have it both ways.
So we have mixed evidence here in terms of the war on Christmas. Because in recent years, and the reason I highlight Starbucks is, again, Fox News and some of the commentators on Fox News, but also the president, President Trump, have highlighted what they see as assaults on Christmas. The fact that Starbucks, people are saying Happy Holidays as opposed to Merry Christmas. And that this is somehow a major issue in the culture. Do you believe it to be so, David?
No. I think it's a wholly, entirely fabricated, culture war that the right is, the right is using it, I think, fairly effectively to rally a certain segment of its base to claim that there is this war on Christmas, that people are hostile to Christmas and therefore, by extension, to Christianity and to the values associated therein.
I mean, when President Trump said, I think it was last year, he made a very prominent play of, you can say Merry Christmas again.
As if people couldn't say Merry Christmas in the previous,
25 years or 250 years. But I would say, in response to that, well, we might have laughed or been disdainful of that, but are you kidding me? He does have a gift for communicating with some of his followers and communicating certain messages in a very concise way. So for certain Christians in America, that very statement by the president said to them, I'm with you, which is one reason. You know, we have this paradox. Why is it evangelical Christians have stood behind, or at least white evangelical Christians have stood behind President Trump despite all the lurid details we've learned about his personal life. Well, I think that kind of message is one of the reasons they conclude when they hear him say that, okay, he's with us on these really important cultural issues. And I think that resonates in a way that is quite significant, and we ignore the significance of that at our peril. I think we misread the culture if we ignore that.
Yeah, no, I think there's a lot of dog whistling going on when he says, you can say Merry Christmas again. And I think if that fits in with Trump's Muslim ban, this idea of there's certain people who belong in the United States and certain people who don't belong in the United States. And there's certain kinds of ideas about, the United States as a Christian nation with a Christian founding that's sort of embedded within this idea of you'll make America great again. You'll be able to say Merry Christmas again. that they're going to harken back to a time before all the, you know, this sort of multicultural corruption in their worldview, destroyed a Christian totality.
So the war on Christmas trope. Well, I agree with you. Yeah. I think it's ridiculous. I don't think there's a war on Christmas. But in asserting that, it resonates in a certain way with people that it's at the tip of an iceberg, if you will, that represents a whole series of other things within the culture war. Yeah. So it may be a front in the culture war. It's more a battle on Christmas or a campaign against Christmas than a war. But it's part of this larger war and a war as they see it on Christianity in America.
And I think it's built on, two fundamentally wrong premises. One is that the people are actually trying to suppress Christmas. I don't think there's any evidence that people are trying to, make people not say Merry Christmas.
No, there's too much money being made and to be made off Christmas.
So I don't, the fact, if you have a war, you have to have somebody like actively fighting against Christmas, and I don't see any evidence of that. And the other half of it is a supposition that the United States has had a traditional kind of version of Christmas going unbroken all the way back into its earliest days, and that the recent, questions about do you say Merry Christmas, do you say Happy Holidays, what exactly is going on in the December end of December period, as if, that's only a very new development that they need to fight against. Because in looking back at the history of Christmas in the United States, my reading of it is that much of what we think of as being traditional Christmas is, in fact, not as old as people think it is. And a lot of it is a relatively recent, innovation. All traditions are invented traditions, but the things that we think of as being traditional Christmas in the United States are only go back 150 years, really. Which I guess then sort of takes us back to sort of the history of Christmas. So Frank, you're the expert on the colonial revolutionary period. If you wanted to go and celebrate Christmas in your hometown of Boston the 17th or 18th centuries, what would you have done?
You wouldn't have done it.
And why not? Were they not any Christians, Frank, Boston?
There were Christians, though, of course. We know that. In fact, some of the most uptight, fastidious, and unpleasant Christians in American history were in New England in the 17th and 18th centuries.
And did they not love Jesus? Why don't they celebrate
Christmas? Well, they didn't celebrate Christmas. Well, the Puritan, the reason they don't celebrate Christmas for much of the colonial period in New England is because many of the original European colonists in New England, of course, were Puritans. And they were Puritans who believed that one should follow the Bible literally, or take the Bible literally. And there is no Christmas in the Bible in the sense of a midwinter celebration. Mm. There is a Christmas in the sense that there's the birth of Jesus. Mm. But because the Christmas as it was celebrated and came to be celebrated elsewhere in the colonies and elsewhere in the early United States is not biblically sanctioned, it was frowned upon in Boston and other parts of New England for most of the colonial period, with the exception Anglicans, Episcopalians celebrated kind of quietly as a midwinter festival. But it was pretty low key. If you wanted to celebrate Christmas in colonial America, you went to points further south. So Benjamin Franklin wrote about the celebration of Christmas a little bit in Philadelphia. And
which was a new thing for him, because he's from Massachusetts originally.
And of course, Philadelphia was for much of the colonial period, a Quaker-dominated city, and the Quakers aren't exactly known for partying.
You joined the wrong Quaker party.
But really, point south. So colonial Virginians, the great planters in Virginia, did celebrate Christmas, not as an especially religious holiday, but as a kind of midwinter holiday, almost a
drinking gambling,
because of course it's the kind of it's a point of relatively low activity in terms of the agricultural calendar, of course, and so they celebrated it, and they celebrated it particularly the Virginia planters, who kind of saw themselves aping the manners of British, particularly English aristocrats, believed that this kind of activity happened in Britain in the 18th century, and it did. So it's more mixed and regional in the 17th and 18th centuries. And it's not that, even for those who do celebrate, it's not that big a holiday. And its religious association is frankly minimal.
I mean, and the Puritans at one point, I think, actually banned the celebration of Christmas.
Yeah, you want to talk about a war on Christmas. They waged war on Christmas. Yeah. They did ban it. I think it was banned until 1682 or something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, so, and it's not the first generation of Puritans who do it because they don't have to ban it because none of them are doing it. It's in, I think, 1659, they pass a law saying, no, not only can we not, are we not going to celebrate Christmas, but if you are in Massachusetts, you're not celebrating Christmas or you're going to jail.
Yeah, and what's interesting about that, David, I mean, is that the kind of the folks who adhere to a particularly doctrinaire version of Christianity in 17th century America actually want to ban Christmas, whereas their kind of theological descendants, and this is a problematic
genealogy,
yeah. But their descendants today are the ones who are in the forefront of the war on Christmas to defend Christmas as traditional and Christian. So, you know, it's interesting because the New Englanders or the Puritans are disdaining it because they see what they associate Christmas with what's going on in Virginia, which is has nothing to do with Christianity and has to do with drinking and
Catholicism.
Right. That's right. That's right.
You know, we think about Washington crossing the Delaware. You know, why is Washington crossing the Delaware on Christmas?
Because those Catholic Hessian soldiers are going to be drunk.
Yeah. How do you sneak up on German soldiers? Well, you make sure they're drunk first, and that's, you know, that was people's, I think, association with Christmas in the, you know, in the 18th century and the very early part of the 19th century. You mentioned Virginia planters. The other people around Virginia planters who are interested in Christmas are slaves, because Christmas had a very particular role in the slave calendar. That was one of the few days where slaves were not working. So you had Christmas off. Sometimes you had a period between Christmas and New Year's off. But it was also then sort of associated with, you know, drinking and celebration rather than a theological celebration of Jesus' birth.
Well, and indeed, I mean, you put your finger on something really important. And on one hand, we've alluded to this, the agricultural calendar allows for, if you're going to give enslaved people time off, that's the time to do it. But also, and we'll get to this in a moment, in terms of the growth of Christmas during the 19th century, but again, one of the reasons Christmas was attractive to working people in 19th century America after the Industrial Revolution was it was a couple of days off.
Yes.
The celebration of Christmas sometimes has a theological and religious basis, but it often is deeply rooted in culture and for cultural reasons that are not necessarily religious, at least in American history.
No, I think that's true.
One thing that surprised me, David, in preparing for this was to learn, I mean, I think our narrative is the traditional one, and it's a good one, which is Christmas is largely a product of the 19th century, especially the Victorian period. I did offer in passing a comment to David that almost everything we like and don't like about modern America starts during his period, not my period. So you get the credit, David, for that.
Or the blame, yes. Okay.
Or the blame. And we see this with Christmas. I think that larger narrative is true. I was surprised, however, to learn that the poem everyone knows, you know, Clement Moore's, allegedly Clement Moore, known as The Night Before Christmas, 'Twas the Night Before Christmas, actually is as early as it was first published anonymously in New York in 1823. So I'm surprised it's that early, because a lot of the tropes we associate with the modern Christmas celebration come from that poem and artifacts like that, if you will. I mean, not explicitly that. And I'm surprised it was that early. So what's going on in the 19th century? How do we get from Puritans outlawing Christmas to Christmas as we know it, which we now know is under threat according to the war on Christmas?
So there's a bunch of things that are happening in the mid-19th century, both in the United States and actually and in Great Britain. And there's a transatlantic element to this. One thing is that there are a number of customs that are being imported from Germany. So things like the Christmas tree.
And let's not forget, Germans are one of the largest immigrant groups to the United States in the mid-19th century.
Yeah, I mean, it's the Irish and the Germans are the two big mid-19th century immigrant groups. But a lot of the sort of tropes of Christmas are imported from Germany. And there's a reason why it gained popularity in Great Britain with Victoria and Albert. You know, if Queen Victoria has a Christmas tree, well, it's good enough for everybody, kind of thing. But you start to see things.
And Dickens, of course.
And Dickens, you know, follows right along with that. So there's a moment in which there are these kinds of tropes of Christmas, some of which are German, that are introduced. You know, now we in Edinburgh have a German Christmas market, which isn't particularly German, but it sort of has that sort of hallmark attached to it. So there's that feature where their German cultural ideas coming in. There's also an effort by Victorians to make Christmas about family and not about drinking. So this idea that what one does during Christmas time is eat a very large bird with one's family members and give gifts. That is something that you know, Victorians, in trying to civilize urban society, that's a trope that they attach to it. Particularly in the American context, the Christmas takes on a particular meaning during the Civil War, in as much as, you know.
You would say that.
It does, because once you start to have these tropes of Christmas, whether it's the Christmas tree, Christmas carols, most of the ones we sing are mid-19th century songs. You know, if Christmas is about family and you are a soldier and you're away from your family, how do you, you know, connect and think with them and be with them, even if you're not physically with them? Christmas is a way of thinking about that. So Christmas takes on a place for soldiers. One of the early depictions we have of Santa Claus is by the Harper's Weekly illustrator Thomas Nast, who is probably the most famous political cartoonist of the 19th century. He has a depiction of Santa Claus, which is one of the earliest ones we've got, that at least it looks like our version of Santa Claus.
Earliest American.
Yes. Published in 1863, and but he's wearing stars and stripes, and he's giving gifts to soldiers. So right in the midst of the Civil War, that's, you know, one of the places where, and Nast is in some ways the iconography of American Santa Claus is, you know, that's this first depiction of him, but Nast does versions of Santa Claus for the next 20 years, and really what we think of, looking here at my Coca-Cola bottle here, or can, and it's got a picture of Santa Claus on it. That's Thomas Nast's version of Santa Claus. And so I think there's a way in which the Civil War particularly makes Christmas and the sort of connection with family important. Christmas becomes a national holiday in 1870, so 5 years after the Civil War. And one of the rationales behind making it a national holiday is part of national reunification. One of the arguments that the Grant administration uses is one of the ways you heal a nation after war is by, you know, coming together as families and coming together in a religious celebration of giving and forgiveness.
What do you think of having Christmas as a national holiday? Personally, this is grist for the War on Christmas folks mill, but I don't think it should be a national holiday. It's a religious holiday. And we have separation of church and state in the United States. It should not be a national holiday.
I would tend to agree with you. In as much as we don't have any other religious holidays as holidays, right? So there's no other point in the calendar that that Americans take off for a religious purpose, which you can read, I think, in two ways. One is that, you know, the United States is a Christian majority country, and that's why, you know, if the majority of people celebrate Christmas, then it makes sense for people not to take it off. On the other half of it is Christmas is often a secular holiday in a way. And so taking it off is about taking time off to be with family and to eat lots of food and give presents and whatnot, more so than it is about the theology of it. I think there's lots of Americans who celebrate Christmas who aren't Christian.
Sure. There are more Americans celebrate Thanksgiving, which, although it has kind of religious origins, is basically a secular holiday where one does many of the same things that one does on Christmas, save give gifts. So I've got less of a problem with Thanksgiving being a national holiday because it's a fairly generic and non-religious celebration. But this is a Christian, as it's currently understood, it's a Christian festival in a country that, you're right, is majority Christian, but it's not officially Christian. Christian,
to be sure.
Notwithstanding the claims of those folks who believe there's a war on Christmas. And similarly, the war on Christmas stuff usually kicks off not over Starbucks cups, but usually over overtly Christian displays on public property. Pretty, so mangers in public square, literally in the public square. And I think, actually, I'm with the American Civil Liberties Union on that. I don't think the government should be putting up manger scenes or creches in the British context in public, on public property, using taxpayer money.
Well, I think one of the things you see happening in the 20th century is the, you know, that Christmas becomes a much more public celebration than it is in the 19th century. The 19th century, it's a celebration about family that you largely do in your home. Christmas becomes, by the end of the 19th century, a more commercial enterprise, so part of it becomes more public in terms of buying and selling things. One of the interesting things I found doing research for this is the advent of Christmas cards. I found a postal official in 1882 saying basically 4 years ago there were no Christmas cards and now we spend all of December sending Christmas, you know, delivering Christmas cards. So you have a kind of commercialization and publicness, but then you finally have, you know, people realizing, hey, we can make a lot of money selling Christmas cards, we can make a lot of money selling Christmas ornaments, we can make a lot of money, you know, selling presents for people to give to one another. And so there's a publicness with the consumption. But it's not, I think, really until you get into the 1920s and then especially into the 1950s when you start to find this widespread effort to put, you know, like nativity scenes in public spaces. That's something, if you went back to the mid-19th century, would have been very foreign. They wouldn't have not, that wouldn't have made any sense to them. Especially not in a political space like a town square or in front of a courthouse or some kind of thing.
So would you draw a distinction between, say, a national Christmas tree or a public Christmas tree and a public manger scene?
I think those are very different kinds of symbols. Or at least I read those as different symbols. I mean, I think the you know, manger scene, you know, is inherently a religious, you know, there's no, you can't divorce that from the religious story embedded within it. A Christmas tree, it's a tree. It's a German tradition. It's relatively recent, So I read those as different, personally. But you know, thinking about this in the 20th century context, and there's, you know, the high points of you know, American religiosity tend to be those places where, you know, Christians are very much interested in putting these symbols in public spaces. And those are the same moments in which non-Christians are pushing back against that. You know, so in the 19-teens and 1920s, there was an effort to put on in Massachusetts, in fact, to put on nativity scenes in schools and teach Christmas in schools and have these kinds of, you know, nativity plays and whatnot. And the Jewish communities in Massachusetts said, no, that's not, we don't, you know, we have public education here, universal public education. We don't want our Jewish children to be forced to participate in a Christian observance in public schools. And, you know, they're able to successfully push back, at least in a few places, in those kinds of locations. But then you have people say, well, that's a war on Christmas. We have Henry Ford, of all people, noted automobile inventor and anti-Semite, said there was a Jewish opposition to Christmas that he found to be un-American.
Which is a very, okay, I mean, that's a very interesting formulation, isn't it? Because, I mean, as you said, Ford was a notorious anti-Semite, but that's associating Judaism, it's basically saying Jewishness and Americanness are incompatible, which goes to the tropes we're hearing today with this, the rise of anti-Semitism or the surge of anti-Semitism at the moment, not just in the United States, but across the West with claims of globalism and things like that.
Anyway,
Ford is clearly using some of that language.
And one of the things he complains about is he says, look, there are Jewish store owners who are profiting from Christmas, therefore they should support Christmas even if they're not Christians. He has some very weird formulations and he urges people to boycott things. You find that again in the 1950s. I mean, 1950s really is the high point in terms of church attendance in the United States. And you're finding, you know, a lot more presence of Christianity in schools in terms of, you know, these kinds of singing Christmas carols in school and having nativity plays in school.
Well, and of course, that's the decade where God is added to the Pledge of Allegiance.
Exactly.
Because it's the Cold War. It's the height of the Cold War. So it's godless communism against we Christians who believe in democracy.
And then this is when you start to find really a lot of these sort of nativity scenes in public spaces. And you have people who are not Christian pushing back against this, largely about oftentimes their children being compelled to participate in them. And you're having people on the right saying, look, these are people who are hate Christmas and hate Christians. The John Birch Society, the sort of right-wing think tank, maybe they might be overselling what the John Birch Society was. They had a pamphlet called There Goes Christmas. And he said, one of the techniques now being applied by the Reds to weaken the pillar of religion in our country is the drive to take Christ out of Christmas. And so they're, you know, trying to, they're arguing both in, there's a, all a critique of consumerism there a little bit, but it's mostly a critique of people who are hostile to public displays of Christian iconography at Christmas time.
They're not wrong in the sense that communists were indeed opposed to Christianity.
Just not in the United States.
No, that's right. That's right. But of course, they're not making a distinction between the global struggle against communism and the internal struggle
to be
against
communism. Yeah, those are all the same. You know, if we're trying to sort of situate the current moment, though, I think a lot of that has to do with events that were happening in the 1980s. Because there's a couple.
In what way?
Well, two things I think are happening. One is there's a series of Supreme Court decisions about the place of prayer in public schools. So, you know, they banned, the Supreme Court says that the prayer in public schools is unconstitutional. There's the thing about the Ten Commandments being posted in public schools. They say that's unconstitutional. And there's, you know, there's a variety of, the jurisprudence is complicated, but one of the steps that lots of schools take, public schools take in starting in the 1980s is doing away with traditional being 30 years old or 40 years old in some cases, but that's as long as people's memories last. You know, Christmas nativity plays and carol services and those things, because they were seen as being an explicit endorsement of religion, and school boards worried about lawsuits and all those kinds of things. So there's a step back from overt expressions of Christmas in schools. I remember at one point when I was in school, kids used to hand out Christmas cards to each other, and the school said you had to stop doing that.
Huh.
You know, because the supposition was, well, if you're, you know, the, and I think at the same time that you're having this, you know, phenomenon happening in schools, you're having in a sort of the broader society a greater recognition that there are lots of people who don't celebrate Christmas, you know, people who celebrate Hanukkah, people who celebrate Kwanzaa, people who, you know, don't celebrate at all. And alongside that, I think a lot of corporations recognize that if they say Merry Christmas on their products, or that might alienate a potential set of consumers. And that's really when the formulation Happy Holidays, I think, rises to the fore, and in many parts of the United States replaces Merry Christmas as the corporate greeting that is given, as it seems.
What do you say?
So here I say, I usually actually say Happy Holidays, mostly because British people don't understand that. Because here, Christmas is weird, or at least...
Well, people say Happy Christmas here, but that...
Yeah, okay, well, they do that, which is, that's weird, too. But sort of the cultural place of Christmas in the United States, in the UK...
Listeners, David speaks for himself.
No, okay.
It's not weird to say Happy Christmas. You've been here 6 years now. You have to start making adjustments.
I teach American history. I am tied to America as a cultural idea.
God. And
Frank is assimilated, and I am tied. You know, he's not a real American anymore. But you know, Britain. One of the differences that I've noticed, at least, is the United States is theoretically a secular country, but celebrates Christmas in a very particular way. Britain is not a secular country in theory, although
in practice
it is. But they have so the default here is still either Merry Christmas or Happy Christmas. I tend to respond with Happy Holidays, in large part because I recognize that a large number of people I'm talking to don't celebrate Christmas.
But what would you do in the U.S. since you're rooted there and you refuse to accept that you live here?
I usually say Happy Holidays.
Yeah, me too.
Partially because I don't often know what the theological orientation is of the people I'm talking to, and if I do, I think there's a political statement embedded within it.
Well, maybe, but if there is, it's only
because
the right has amped up this election war on Christmas. So suddenly this is once President Trump says you can say Merry Christmas again, even though people were never prohibited from saying it, not saying it also becomes a political statement. But I think it's a fundamentally, I agree with you and your reasoning. I think it's just polite to be inclusive in your language if you don't know someone's orientation. Now, I guess I have friends who I know are very devout Christians. I think if I were speaking to them, I would say Merry Christmas if I knew that. But I think if I don't know somebody's views or background or position on this, Happy Holidays is more inclusive.
I would agree. One of the things when people wish you or wish me a Merry Christmas is there's a supposition that they know what my theological orientation is.
Yeah, I just say thanks. If somebody's giving you a greeting and intending to be nice.
I'm always tempted to say Happy Hanukkah in response, just to see, I don't, but I thought it was great. The rhetoric on the war on Christmas, I think as we've sort of talked about here, is very much rooted in, these culture wars that have been raging in the United States since the 1980s, but then especially since the rise of Fox News and other media outlets, which is both a reflection of changing political norms and also a shaper of political norms. And I think there's an active hostility embedded within saying Merry Christmas in the United States right now, at least among some valences of it, against people who are not Christian.
Unless you say to people who are Christian in a really sarcastic way.
Merry Christmas, by the way, to all of our listeners who celebrate the said holiday. But one of the things that has happened, I think, since the 1980s is a greater visibility of non-Christian celebrations in December. So I think Hanukkah right now has a much greater awareness culturally in the United States than it did, in the 1950s or 60s or at any really other point in American history. Now, granted, Hanukkah in the United States has in some ways been shaped in part because of its proximity to Christmas, yes, in terms of the way it's culturally expressed. There's been the rise of Kwanzaa as a cultural celebration that really becomes much more prominent in the 80s and 90s, a celebration of African spiritual heritage that is, during the same season as Christmas, but sort of adjacent to it. We have, of course, the most important
Festivus.
That's what I was thinking. Most important recent innovation in the American spiritual calendar of December, Festivus. For the rest of us, for those of you who are not familiar with this, Google the Seinfeld episode. But, you know, I don't know. I mean, we're laughing about Festivus, but I think it's...
I think Festivus is great.
Yeah, airing of grievances and the...
Feats of strength.
which will make no sense to listeners who haven't watched that Seinfeld episode. But, you know, I think that episode, if we're going to sort of, you know, tease it apart, is speaking to, you know, people who are in some ways attracted to the some elements of the holiday season, but are actually repelled by some of the theological elements of it. You know, one of the, I think, central tensions right now in ways in which Americans celebrate Christmas is it is this huge part of the consumer calendar. This, you know, it's when Americans buy lots of crap. It's when businesses hope to make the money to, you know, end the year, you know, in the black. It's the, so there's this huge commercialization of Christmas. On the other hand, there's a trope that we should, you know, keep Christ in Christmas, that religious conservatives, you know, who are sometimes both participating in consumer Christmas, but also worried that consumer Christmas is overwhelming, you know, their version of the theology of Christmas, even if it would have pissed off the Puritans. You know, and you can find those two things sort of wedded together in weird ways. This Hallmark movie industry where they make dozens and dozens of Christmas movies that some people love and other people loathe, you know, which are both consumer products that are embedded upon telling you that consumerism isn't important. That's the central trope, I think, of all those movies, that you should value family and love and kindness and charity and not value stuff embedded within a product that is sold to you. Do you have any particular Christmas traditions that you keep, Frank?
Oh, lots. I mean, my wife is Swedish, so we kind of fuse U.S., British, and Swedish.
Well, this is Christmas a really multicultural Christmas.
Well, sure. And so we have our big, we have a big Swedish Yule board, as it's called, like a smorgasbord, but on Christmas Eve. So our big meal is on Christmas Eve. We've recently, so my children are in their 20s now, and my daughter's just come home for Christmas the other night. We're trying to, we've had a tree up for a while, but we haven't decorated yet because we're waiting for both kids to be home at the same time. But their commitments and schedules are so complicated. We may not...
We schedule time to decorate the tree.
And I said, well, we might be doing it on Christmas Eve. My wife said, well, you know, in Sweden that used to be the case. You would decorate the tree on Christmas Eve. I said, okay, well... fair enough. So we might be doing it Swedish this year. Although at this rate, we might not get to it till Boxing Day, which is the day after Christmas here in the UK. So we kind of blend the Christmas traditions of the place we live and the places we come from. But what happens in families, I'm sure this is true in yours, is you develop your own traditions within that broader tradition, the things you always do. And so, yeah, but it's all about our family getting together. I mean, and it's our immediate nuclear family.
That's very Victorian.
Well, we used to travel. We used to go see family in either Sweden or the United States, and we'd alternate. But traveling with young children at Christmas time is awful. It's hell. And particularly, you got to bring the presents, you have to do this, that, and the other thing. And so it was about 15 or 20 years ago that we said, okay, we're staying in Scotland. If you want to come and see us, you're more than welcome. But we'll be here. And since then, we've developed a kind of Christmas tradition with our nuclear family that maybe is Victorian, but is actually quite nice. What about you?
We get a tree. We do the presents thing, sort of. We make gingerbread houses.
Okay.
In fact, that's happening today. That's exciting. And my daughter and I watch them up at Christmas Carol.
Okay. Nice.
Which, you know.
You don't watch it with the boys?
I tried to, but they weren't as into the Muppets or Charles Dickens. So, but Muppet Christmas
Carol. Muppet Christmas Carol works on a number of levels. Well, yes. It helps if you have some knowledge of Dickens or interest in Dickens and or the Muppets. Muppets,
yes. But it's got Michael Caine in it. Have you seen it?
Yes, yes. No, it's amazing. It's good.
It makes me cry every
time. I don't love lots of Christmas movies.
No, I hate
Christmas movies. So It's a Wonderful Life is okay, but yeah. Die Hard is a good Christmas movie. And what's your view on Christmas music?
Oh, I hate Christmas music.
Yeah, you and me.
I used to work at a Starbucks, and they require you to, usually they have a variety of things you can listen to as the sort of background music. Christmas time, they make you listen to Christmas music, and the CD had 8 songs on it. And at one point, we decided to say, damn it, we've been listening to this for 8 hours. We're switching out the CD. Got a call from corporate headquarters saying you need to switch the CD back.
Wow.
And I have no idea how they were checking what CD we were playing, but they were upset we weren't playing.
And
the
they
Christmas
were songs. And I assume they were the more secular Christmas songs, not the
I mean they were all the, you know, corporate Christmas awfulness.
What was interesting in terms of the iconography of Christmas, that I noticed recently is I was at a conference in Santiago in Chile last week, and of course Christmas is coming in the Southern Hemisphere as well as the Northern Hemisphere, but it was 85 degrees most days. But the signs and everything and the kind of iconography around Christmas was still about snow and trees and so
exactly.
on, and which was seemed a little bit incongruous. I mean, there was loads of Christmas music. It was all in Spanish, of course, but it was but Christmas music was ubiquitous. But it was interesting to go into shops and so on and see that. I mean, it was the same impulse to sell and celebrate in that way and gift buying, but the iconography didn't quite fit with the weather. For what's a midsummer holiday rather than a midwinter holiday.
To be sure. All right. That actually sort of ties in well, I guess, with our last drops. So, Frank, what's your last drop?
My last drop is, and I want to apologize because this could sound obnoxious and I don't intend it to do so. I want to recommend the Museum of Memory and Human Rights in Santiago in Chile. Now, I realize most of our listeners probably have not been there and may not get to go there, but it is a fabulous museum and it does have a website. So have a look at their website. But the reason I'm endorsing it is it's a museum which is dedicated to, and there's obviously an American connection here, to the to commemorating and addressing the human rights violations and crimes that were committed during the Pinochet regime from roughly 1973 until 1990 in Chile. And it's incredibly well done. It's very, very moving. And of course, the American dimension to this is the United States supported the coup that overthrew Salvador Allende and brought Augusto Pinochet to power and propped up that regime, which committed these human rights abuses. Interestingly, it was also there at the end because there was some they produced some documents, declassified documents from the American intelligence agencies in 1989 when they held up the plebiscite that led to the overthrow. Or the ouster of Pinochet, and there were some documents there with the CIA saying, 17 years later, you know, you've got to go and don't try to interfere with this plebiscite. But it's harrowing and moving at the same time, but is very, very powerful and tastefully done as far as museums of this kind. I can strongly recommend it. I know that most of you probably won't get to go to Santiago. If you do get the opportunity to go to Santiago, by all means, go.
Is this a relatively new museum?
I'm not. Yeah, I think so.
Okay. I was in Santiago 20 years ago, and I don't remember going there, but that may have just been...
Yeah, 20 years ago was probably slightly too close to the actual events. I mean, I had an interesting conversation with a history student at the Apostolic University who was kind of showing us around, and I asked her about how people feel about how do they deal with the Pinochet years? And she said, oh, there's a big debate about that, and a big division, unsurprisingly. Some people, I think the people who supported the regime, are calling for 50 years of silence, saying we shouldn't talk about this, we have to reconcile and just leave it behind. And others are saying we need to confront the past. And it's an interesting debate, and we've seen it in other places like South Africa, about how countries deal with the difficult recent past and move on. And the museum is all about that. It's an interesting model for how to address this. And what was really striking was how busy it was. There were loads of Chileans in there. And how engaged and really moved by things, by the exhibitions that people wore. So I can strongly recommend it. And they had a kind of thing where they were talking about similar human rights abuses globally. So they talked about other areas of the world. There was an exhibition about the treatment of indigenous people in Chile. Very, very good museum. Anyway, what's your last
one? Actually, mine is also connected to memory, sort of. It's a show on Amazon Prime called Homecoming.
Right, I haven't heard of this. Okay, this not is, Homeland.
No, it's Homecoming. It's you know, one of these sort of 8-part, I think maybe there's 10 parts, miniseries. It starts as Julia Roberts, whom usually I'm not a huge fan of, but in this I think she's quite good. It's a drama about soldiers coming back from war and who are suffering from PTSD and who are coping with memories. And they're at a facility. It's a story about a facility that tries to help them cope with their memories or not cope with their memories, as the case may be. And it's got some interesting, sort of weird, slightly sci-fi elements to it. But it's very much sort of grounded in the particular moment we're in now with people coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan with PTSD.
And it's a TV series.
It's a TV series, but it's based, and this is part of the reason why I'm recommending it, it is based on a podcast.
Oh, wait. So there's a possibility
of a podcast becoming a major TV series starring Hollywood actors.
Right. I see where you're going with this. And I think the listener value is ripe for such a treatment.
Yeah, so
the question is, who will play us?
Yes. If you are a producer in Hollywood land or, you know, with Amazon or... Oh, we'll go Netflix. We'll go, you know, Hulu. We're not particular with the... But, yeah... Listeners, if you have ideas about who we should play us in the show, tweet us with your recommendations. You know.
Oh, this could end very badly.
Oh, this could end very, very, very badly.
Well, David, as a bearded fat man, this is my time of year, so I would like to wish you a Merry Christmas.
Oh, and Happy Holidays. Cheers.
The Whiskey Rebellion is hosted by David Silkenet and Frank Cogliano. David is a senior lecturer in American history at the University of Edinburgh, and Frank is professor of American history and Dean International for North America at the University of Edinburgh. The Whiskey Rebellion is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and Podbean. You can follow the show on Twitter at WhiskeyRebelPod and like the show on Facebook for updates about current and future episodes.